It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Somali and African Union forces continue their advance against al-Shabaab militants. Egypt's armed forces chief makes it official. He's running for president. I'm Victor Beatty, reporting from Washington. In Somalia, government and African Union forces seized the central town of El Bor in the latest in a series of advances against al-Shabaab militants. The AU mission in Somalia, AMISOM, said Wednesday forces regained control of the town, 350 kilometers northeast of the capital Mogadishu, in a three-day operation. AMISOM says the joint forces have liberated 10 towns since the beginning of the offensive against al-Qaeda-linked group last month. The offensive comes as Kenya clamps down on Somali refugees in the country, ordering them back to two camps following recent attacks and threats by Islamist militants. VOA's Gabe Josler reports the directive could impact tens of thousands of refugees working and living outside the camps.
Kenya's high court last year rejected a previous attempt by the government to force refugees back into camps, saying the order threatened the rights and fundamental freedoms of those living in urban areas. On Sunday, gunmen opened fire at a church near Mombasa, killing six people and injuring many others. A week earlier, a load of explosives was discovered in a car parked outside police headquarters in the city. The Somali militant group al-Shabaab has taken responsibility for recent attacks in Kenya, including last year's siege on the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi. Hassan Guled, chairman of the Somali business community in Nairobi, says most refugees are simply trying to make a living and should not be treated like terrorists.
One who is having a business in Nairobi or Mombasa and who is a serious businessman and who X is living from here, I don't think will support a terrorism. The terrorists we see are young people who are confused and who are sent to come and do bad things.
Kenya has played host to hundreds of thousands of refugees from Somalia in its Dadaab and Kakuma camps, which opened in the early 1990s. But insecurity has remained a challenge in the camps, with occasional attacks on aid workers and government personnel blamed on Somali militants. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Egyptian Army Chief General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has officially announced he's resigning from the armed forces so he can run for president next month. Internationally televised speech Wednesday, the general said he will seek the presidency and will be honored for the support of his viewers. He said Egypt is threatened by terrorists, and now is the time to restore and rebuild the country with dignity. His decision to run has been widely expected and will likely have the backing of the powerful military. The defense chief was the principal military figure in last year's ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, following months of mass protests against his rule. Earlier Wednesday, Egyptian security forces and supporters of the ousted president clashed, leaving one person dead. Officials say at least eight were wounded in the fighting near Cairo University. Meanwhile, state media reports the interim government is preparing for two new mass trials of Islamists in Minya, the same location where a judge Monday handed down the mass death sentences of hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood members for the murder of a policeman and other acts of violence. Nigeria's new central bank chief on Wednesday vowed to ensure economic stability to create jobs and boost growth. Godwin M. Fiela won parliamentary approval, replacing Lamido Sanusi, who was removed last month on charges of financial recklessness and misconduct. Mr. Sanusi denies any wrongdoing, saying his ouster was politically motivated for investigating official corruption. Mr. Emma Fiele vowed to maintain a strong exchange rate in order to build up foreign reserves and to address the country's chronic employment problem, especially among Nigeria's young people. The country's Bureau of Statistics says unemployment among people under the age of 25 is close to 38%. Moroccan police used water cannon to stop a group of blind, unemployed university graduates from setting themselves on fire in Rabat to protest a public sector hiring freeze. Morocco is under international pressure to address its deficit in public spending by enacting austerity measures in January. Labor unions say they are planning mass protests in coming weeks. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will make long-delayed visits to Morocco and Algeria next week. In Algiers, he'll co-chair the U.S.-Algeria Strategic Dialogue covering bilateral and regional issues. He'll co-chair a similar meeting in Rabat. His visit comes ahead of a planned U.N. Security Council vote on renewing the mandate of the peacekeeping force in Western Sahara. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Some of these stories can be found and read online at our website, voanews.com.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Egypt's army chief resigns and declares his candidacy for president.
Field Marshal Sisi said he was resigning as defense minister and running for president in an announcement on state TV after a meeting of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces.
That's VOA correspondent Edward Urania in Cairo. A Malawi presidential candidate calls for a violence-free campaign ahead of the May 20th election. We'll tell you how the South Sudan town of Malakal is doing after seeing some of the worst fighting recently. And a former Ivory Coast youth leader makes his first appearance at the ICC today, Thursday.
The initial appearance is only a hearing in order to ensure that first the identity of the person and the language in which he will be capable of following the procedure.
Fadi El Abdallah is the spokesman for the International Criminal Court. A new report says being rich does not guarantee better health for a country. And Amnesty International says there was a spike in the number of death penalties last year. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Egyptian Defense Minister and Army Commander Abdel Fattah al-Sisi announced in a televised address Wednesday night that he was resigning his defense posts to run for president in an election expected to take place next month. As Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo, the announcement ended weeks of speculation that Sisi was planning to run.
Field Marshal Sisi said he was resigning as defense minister and running for president in an announcement on state TV after a meeting of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that included interim president Adli Mansour. He says that he is appearing for the last time in a military uniform after 45 years of service to the nation, but will continue to defend it in a new role. He said, "No one can be president against the will of the people and without its support, unlike times of old." The announcement came as little surprise after weeks of speculation and rumor that General Sisi was going to run. In his address, he appealed to the Egyptian people to support him in his bid for president. He says that he is presenting his candidacy for president in all humility and asking for the honor of the people's support. He says that he will level with people about the state of affairs as he always has. The general said Egyptians have the right to live in dignity and in freedom, but that everyone must work and produce to give Egypt its rightful place among civilized nations. He also said Egypt is for all its citizens and must exclude no one. The announcement came against a backdrop of sporadic clashes between police and student supporters of the now banned Muslim Brotherhood at Cairo University and several other spots in Cairo. Police fired tear gas by mid-afternoon and several casualties were reported. Supporters of General Sisi rallied in several other locations of the capital as fireworks went off in anticipation of the presidential announcement. Egypt's Council of Ministers is due to meet Thursday morning to appoint a successor to General Sisi as Army Chief and Defense Minister. Arab satellite channels reported that veteran General Subhi Sudki had been promoted by one rank and will succeed General Sisi. Prime Minister Ibrahim Mahlab said his government would remain impartial in the electoral process. One other candidate, secular politician Hamdin Sabahi, has said he is running. The Muslim Brotherhood indicated on its website that General Sisi's candidacy is clear proof that he plotted to overthrow elected President Mohamed Morsi. Mr. Morsi was ousted last July after days of popular demonstrations against him. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Charles Blaise Goudé, a youth minister in former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's administration, is scheduled to make an initial appearance before a judge at the International Criminal Court today, Thursday. Blaise Goudé is accused of four counts of crimes against humanity, including murder, rape, and other forms of sexual violence. ICC spokesman Fadi El Abdallah tells reporter Peter Clotty that during the initial hearing, a judge will verify Blaise Goudé's identity and the language in which he is able to follow the proceedings.
The initial appearance is only a hearing in order to ensure that, first, the identity of the person and the language in which he will be capable of following the procedure, and also to inform him and to ensure that he understands the charges that are brought against him. And at the end of it, the judge would indicate what would be the date for the confirmation of charges hearing, which will be in a few months. From now, the confirmation of charges hearing is a preliminary step that allows the judges to decide whether or not the prosecutor has sufficient evidence justifying to hold a trial for this case. And if there are no sufficient evidence, the judges can stop the proceeding at the preliminary stage.
But the ICC has initially instituted an arrest warrant against Charles Blaise Goudé. Is it safe to say that, therefore, the ICC has enough evidence?
Yes, of course, but an arrest warrant is issued based on the element of evidence that has been presented by the prosecutor. But at the time, there was no possibility for the defense to know and to challenge this evidence. So there is a need for this additional step, which is the confirmation of charges, for the defense to be informed of the evidence that the prosecutor has, to be able to challenge that and to present to the judges the results of their own investigation or counter-investigation about all this before the judges makes a finding whether or not to commit this case for a trial.
I spoke with some people in Ivory Coast, and it appears that supporters of the former president of Ivory Coast say that this is yet another case of victor's justice, and that those who are supporters of former President Gbagbo are being prosecuted by the ICC, though there is ample evidence that both sides committed the atrocities. Is this the case of victor's justice here in Ivory Coast, Dr. Abdallah?
The answer is a strong no. First, the prosecutor investigates in the framework that has been established by the chamber, and the chamber directed the prosecutor to investigate allegations of crimes against humanity allegedly committed by both camps. And, of course, we have first three arrest warrants that have been issued and made public. And we know already the position of the prosecutor, who indicated in her statement last Saturday that this is not the end of the work of the prosecution in Ivory Coast. The investigations are continuing, and they are collecting more evidence. And where warranted and as warranted, the prosecutor will bring further cases before the ICC judges without fear or favor, and irrespective of sides or political affiliation of the perpetrators.
Fadi El Abdallah is the spokesman for the International Criminal Court. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from The Hague. A presidential candidate in Malawi's upcoming May 20th election is calling for an issue-based campaign free of violence. Abtupile Muluzi of the opposition United Democratic Front Party and the son of former President Bakili Muluzi says this means that all candidates must tell their followers to refrain from any kind of violent acts and castigating their opponents. There has been a flare-up of pre-election violence leading recently to the deaths of a police officer and a civilian. Muluzi tells me he is running for president because he represents a new generation of Malawian leaders who are well-placed to bring about economic change for Malawians.
First of all, our economy has been facing a downward spiral for the last decade. Currently, GDP growth has declined to 1.9% in recent years. And also Malawians are paying a heavy price for sluggish progress. This is an important year for Malawians, as we will be celebrating 50 years after our independence. So therefore, Malawians are looking for a step change in the way we have been doing business in Malawi. And I'm representing a new generation of leadership in Malawi. I'm representing a fresh start, a new beginning for Malawi.
If you say that currently, economically and development-wise, that the country isn't doing that well for the past 50 years, people say, doesn't the blame also go on your father, who was also president of Malawi?
Absolutely. I think we have to blame all the administrations. last decades demonstrated that we have not managed to provide for our people, and we face numerous challenges, and we need to fix that. And my party is a party that fought for economic freedom, for social freedom, for political freedom. And I believe it's uniquely placed to reposition itself for this new phase, this new era, where we bring a new generation of leadership to usher in economic change for our people.
Dominating the political season in Malawi is this whole cash gate scandal. What do you make of this scandal?
Well, this scandal, I mean, is theft of government resources. Let me say that this has damaged the reputation of Malawi considerably. It has demonstrated that our governments are unable to manage the public purse, that we've been unable to manage our own resources transparently. And this is why Malawians are demanding that we have to do things differently.
It seems this electoral process is being marred by violence. Everyone is blaming each other in terms of who is responsible for the political violence.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very closely fought election, and obviously the tensions are running high. I've been calling for a new type of politics. I have been calling for an issue-based campaign. But what I have been calling on leaders to do is to quality leadership is absolutely vital. And it means as leaders telling our supporters to refrain from politics of castigation, to refrain from violent acts. I have personally taken initiative to state that any member of my party that is known or seen to be castigating opponents will be suspended from the party.
Atupile Muluzi is the presidential candidate for the opposition United Democratic Front Party of Malawi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Blantyre. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 27th. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Now that the town of Malakal, South Sudan's Upper Nile state capital, appears to be firmly under the control of government forces, officials are encouraging residents who fled when anti-government forces took control of the town in mid-December to come home. As Charlton Doki reports from Juba for VOA's South Sudan in Focus program, local officials say the situation in Malakal is now safe.
When fighting broke out between pro-government and anti-government forces in Malakal last month, more than 20,000 residents fled to a nearby UN camp for safety. Thousands of others fled to neighboring towns including Melut, Wau Shiluk, Makal Shiluk and Lelo. Upper Nile State's Information Minister, Philip Jiben Ogal, says the town is still quiet and deserted, but residents are slowly returning.
The security is normal in Upper Nile, in Malakal particularly. The morning people come out from the UNAMIS and Makal Shiluk, so they're moving to see the houses. They used to go back to the compound of the UNAMIS.
During last month's fighting, Malakal was completely destroyed. Dozens of dead bodies lay in the streets. Jiben, who is also Upper Nile State spokesperson, says the town's authorities are working with humanitarian agencies, including the South Sudan Red Cross, to remove debris from the town.
The town needs to be cleaned, so now we are working to clean the towns and then maintain the town back to be normal, and also to collect the dead body or the bones of the people. That is what I want to tell you.
2 weeks ago, state authorities had temporarily relocated the state capital to Renk near the border with Sudan, fearing the town was vulnerable to another attack. Jiben says now that government forces have regained control of Malakal, all state officials will be moving back to Malakal and basic services will be provided to residents who return.
We want to bring the services to the town, particularly running communication. Because now the communication is not there, so we want to establish the communication network. And also the water and all of things should be maintained. And then people, they can go home to houses.
Jiben realizes that some residents may not want to return to Malakal immediately since they have lost everything during the fighting. He says officials are still working to establish the number of people killed in the town since pro- and anti-government forces first clashed in the town in late December. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Amnesty International says Iran and Iraq are behind a spike in the number of death penalties carried out worldwide in 2013. The group said China topped the list, followed by Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. Henry Richwell reports for VOA from London.
A sharp rise in the number of executions in Iraq and Iran contributed to an unexpected spike in death penalties carried out worldwide in 2013, says Amnesty International's Audrey Gogran.
We've reported on 369 executions carried out in Iran last year, which is deeply troubling, and a number of people have commented on the scale of executions in Iran. But we also believe that more executions may have taken place.
Amnesty reported 169 executions in Iraq. Somalia also contributed to the spike, with 34 recorded executions.
Many of the executions that we recorded this year were in the autonomous region of Puntland. I would have to stress that the executions that we've recorded in Somalia as a whole are likely to be under-recorded.
Amnesty says it believes that China tops the list of numbers of prisoners executed every year, with estimates in the thousands. Earlier this month, China's top legislative body, the National People's Congress, said Beijing was considering reducing the number of crimes subject to the death penalty.
Currently, we have included the amendment to the criminal law in the annual legislative agenda. We are considering reducing the number of crimes subject to the death penalty step by step.
China still keeps its policies on capital punishment highly secretive, says Audrey Gogran.
Until the Chinese authorities start publishing death sentences and executions and making these public, it won't be possible to confirm whether their claims that they're reducing the use of the death penalty are in fact true.
The United States was fifth on the list with 39 executions in 2013, one place behind Saudi Arabia with 79. Pharmaceutical companies in the US have begun refusing to supply the drugs needed for lethal injections, forcing state authorities to turn to more loosely regulated companies known as compounding pharmacies. Several death row inmates have launched court cases against their sentences, arguing that the use of less regulated pharmaceuticals could cause significant pain and is inhumane. Last month, Michael Taylor, convicted of raping and killing a teenager in 1989, lost his court case and was executed in Missouri. Amnesty says a total of 22 countries worldwide carried out the death penalty in 2013, one less than in 2012. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Getting wealthier does not automatically make a country healthier. According to new research, the study questions whether promoting economic growth is the best way to improve child nutrition in low- and middle-income countries. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
Harvard School of Public Health professor Subbu Subramanian says the conventional wisdom on how developing countries should improve children's health is basically this.
Let's just go after economic growth and then everything else will just follow.
But he says that's not always the case. India is booming, for example. The country's gross domestic product, or GDP, the most common measure of the economy, has been growing by more than 5% per year for most of the past two decades. That's faster than most Western countries. But more than two-fifths of India's children are underweight, and nearly half are stunted. And that has not changed much since the early 1990s. Subramanian and his colleagues wondered if economic growth was failing to reach children in other countries as well. So they looked at health surveys conducted since 1990 in 36 low- and middle-income countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. Writing in the journal The Lancet Global Health, they found that when they compared the impact of GDP growth on indicators of child malnutrition, like stunted growth and being underweight, the effect was
practically zero to very, very small.
For every 5% growth in GDP, there was a less than 1% decrease in stunting, for example. Subramanian says that's because investments that raise GDP are not the ones that will improve child health. He criticizes India for building new highways and airports, while much of the country lacks basic sanitation. GDP growth needs to be funneled into clean water and sewers, childhood immunizations, breastfeeding promotion, and so on, he adds.
Without these direct investments, what we are seeing is, like, you know, economic growth by itself is not making much impact.
But the conclusion that economic growth has little or no impact on child nutrition drew this reaction from Lawrence Haddad, head of the Institute for Development Studies.
We think that's crazy.
Haddad says, look at countries like Vietnam, Ghana, or Brazil, where malnutrition has come way down in the last 20 years. Economic growth accounts for half of those declines, he says.
And the other half is attributable to strategic investment in water, sanitation, health systems, nutrition programs.
He says it takes both GDP growth and the right investments to raise child nutrition rates. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Tunisian defending champions CS Sfaxien overpowered Libya's El Ahly Benghazi 25-14, 25-17 and 25-16 in quarterfinal action at the Africa Men's Volleyball Club Championships in Sousse, Tunisia on Wednesday. Tunisia's Esperance beat Algeria's Etoile Setif by 3-1, as Egypt's El Ahly dismissed Algeria's Borj Bouj Araiji in 3 straight sets. In another quarterfinal, Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel eliminated Libya's El Ahly Tripoli by 3-1. Today, Thursday, the semifinals take place, in which Egypt's El Ahly challenge defending champions CS Sfaxien, while in an all-Tunisian affair, Etoile du Sahel play Esperance. Moving on to cycling, Frenchman Damien Monnier carried the day on the third stage of the Tour of Constantine in eastern Algeria on Wednesday. He was followed across the finish line by Algeria's Hicham Chabane and third place Youssef Regouigui. Today, Thursday, the cyclists compete over the fourth stage of the contest, covering 137 kilometers. In football news, bronze medalists Ghana tackle Italy in quarterfinal action at the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup in San Jose, Costa Rica, today, Thursday. Later, Nigeria face Spain in another quarterfinal match to be played in Liberia. Finally, the Africa Wrestling Championships gets underway in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, tomorrow, Friday. The men and women vying for honors over the next 3 days will seek to establish their credentials ahead of the World Championships next year. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Thursday morning, March 27th.
The ongoing terrorism in Benue State, the food basket of the nation, is a call on the federal government to take an urgent measure in combating the barbaric acts. Otherwise, the unprecedented starvation shall affect the entire nation. Bring John Usher in Obanuku, Cross of Australia, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Egyptian Army Chief General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has officially announced that he is resigning from the armed forces so that he can run in a presidential election that he is expected to win easily. In a speech on state television on Wednesday, the general said Egypt is threatened by terrorists and that now is the time to restore and rebuild the country with dignity. That's it for this Thursday, March 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, along with all of our engineers, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing everybody a very lovely Thursday.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.